is Foreign Domestic and Forbidden, the podcast about books and ideas. I'm Tim Trash.
And I am Joaquin Lobo.
And we'll be your hosts for the next hour. Usually I ask Joaquin how he's doing, but now I know that he's not doing so well because your house was broken into this morning. How's that going?
It's going okay. Someone broke a window through a rock and slid the other window, came into the house, went through my wife's office and our bedroom, stole a bunch of jewelry, watches, iPads, anything that he could find. And I feel that we're lucky because no one was inside. We didn't have any, you know, major losses. It was mostly stuff that has some financial economic value, some monetary value, but we feel very lucky that it's something that we can fix, we can replace, and then we can move on to the next thing. What really, you know, bothers me or anyone in these type of circumstances is the fact that someone comes into your family space, walks into your son's room, your wife's office, your own bedroom, opens your drawers, goes through everything, trying to find things, and that, you know, those hands, those steps into that private domain feel as a major sort of assault to your intimacy. So that's what bothers me. But, you know, the main thing now is to assure my son when he comes back that we're safe, that he shouldn't worry about anything, that this was one of those random things that happen when someone wants to make a quick buck.
That's really horrible. I mean, that is such a violation of just, I mean, the interior space, the personal space is also sort of the thinking space, and I can be myself here, and this is horrible. I'm really.
I'll save for another episode the account of my kidnapping so we can compare violations to personal space, and I'll talk about being stabbed and taken by a gang in Mexico City. But I don't have time to go through that. So, you know, I'm glad that I remember to be here, because I've been really busy all day talking to the bank and talking to my insurance. Thank God I have home insurance. So I've been doing all these things that you do to protect your money, your account, your credit. And I remember to come, and I wasn't gonna miss it. So I'm really looking forward to talking to our guests. I've been doing some research on what he does, and I'm very excited. I just didn't want to miss it for anything.
I'm so sorry. This is really terrible. But I am also excited about our guest, very special guest, Jeff Parker is here. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Hey, Tim. Hey, Joaquin.
Jeff Parker is the author of a lot of strange and wonderful books. He's really a man of letters. He has done his own work, his own fiction and nonfiction. The Taste of Penny, a short story collection, Oven Man, a novel, and a really interesting and really wonderful nonfiction book, Where Bears Roam the Streets, a Russian journal, which is a wonderful account of his travels in Russia. But he has also written and co-authored really super quirky and beautiful books like Erratic Fire, Erratic Passion, which is a book of found sports poetry and a really fantastic and fascinating read. He has edited, co-edited A Manner of Being, Writers on Their Mentors, and he has also translated and edited Russian writers into anthologies, Raskazi and America. And also he has co-translated the novel Sankhya by Zaka Prilepin, and I'm probably butchering the name. And he's currently teaching at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And He's really a super like international guy. Not only has he lived and co-directed literary programs in Russia, in St. Petersburg, but he's also now the co-director, co-founder and director of the Disquiet International Literary Program in Lisbon, Portugal. And I think you guys are starting up to be in person in Lisbon again this year, right?
Yeah, that's right. This is our delayed 10th edition.
It's a cool anniversary.
Yeah.
What are the dates on that? And where can people find it?
So the website is disquietinternational.org. And the dates this year, June 26th to July 9th. So.
I have a question. Is the name of this festival directly connected to Fernando Pessoa's poetry, Disquiet, Desassossego?
Yeah, we were flailing around for a name, and that was the first one we thought of, and then we thought of many others, and sometimes the most obvious one is the right one. So
it's beautiful. It's perfect. Yeah.
Because it really did, for me, it just, the whole notion of desassossego, it really captured the idea behind doing these international writing workshops for North American writers, because the whole idea is to take you out of the context of your normal life, insert you in a completely different street vernacular, just change your context completely and see what that does to you as a writer. See what that does to your writing, to disquiet you, in other words. So we have a lot of fun.
And there are always photographs of students in front of the Pessoa statue in Lisbon. Those are pretty cool.
Yeah, I think Pessoa is a really interesting figure for for American writers in particular, because I don't know how it seems to you guys, but it seems to me that American literature is all about the individual, it's all about the I, it's all about the true self. It's all about, if you want to extrapolate out to creative writing workshop, it's all about finding your true voice, And, finding that one true expression of yourself. That's what it seems to me American literature is obsessed with. And Pessoa, Fernando Pessoa, great Portuguese poet, is the complete opposite of that. Pessoa says, for those who don't know, Pessoa had 90 some odd heteronyms, as he called them, that he wrote in the voices of, but they were fully developed, fully expressed characters. He had backstories for them. He had occupations for them. Some of them were immigrants. Some of them were women. They were fully.
They wrote about each other's poetry.
They wrote about each other's poetry, right? Because one week, Suarez would publish a poem in a journal, and the next week, Cairo would write a scathing review of that poem. but his whole idea is that we are many voices, we are many people, always at once. And I just think, for me, it's such an important idea, and it really goes directly against this whole mythology of the individual. It's so relaxing, actually. You don't have to find your true voice. You don't have to express your one true self, because you are many.
I love that you talk about that. Just makes, it made me think about Walt Whitman and that sort of obsession with the I, in a very positive way, if you want, very creative, very appealing in terms of constructing a persona that can say something through music or through poetry. But, you know, it doesn't begin with Whitman. There's a history of emphasis on the first person and self-affirmation, self-reliance, if you want, to go all the way back to Emerson. And it doesn't get any better. I mean, it looks like we're more and more trying to find refuge in the I and to isolate ourselves from everything else. And if it's not social media, it's something else. But there's this sort of pervasive appetite for isolation and for affirmation of the self that keeps you from the joy of not being yourself, the joy of discovering, you know, others within you, like Pessoa did, and free yourself from yourself, in other words, which is something that probably lay at the bottom of that desire to write other poems in other voices.
Amen. Yeah. Free yourself from yourself.
Coming of age in 1980s Berlin, there was also a fluidity to the identity politics, and you could be many different people during your day or in the span of a year or two, and artificial identities were just as true as whatever your normal everyday identity might be. And yeah, I think too, here in America, and especially right now at this point, the search for this one slot, the one niche you can claim as your own and that defines you is making people smaller in many ways instead of bigger. It only allows them to write from one single perspective, only to experience the world from one identity, when really we have so many different identities, or we can assume so many different identities. And that also cuts down on the freedom of the writer to write from all kinds of different perspectives and have just conversations with oneself in different guises. So yeah, there's definitely a totally different angle looking at literature or what the self is, what the self can be.
Do you think that you became a novelist because of that, Jeff? That was a way of, you know, walking into other people's lives, or making things up for, to see things from other perspectives?
Yeah, I think so. That's maybe what creates the entry point. But then when you start trying to do that, you realize just how challenging that is. And I don't know, maybe it sounds contradictory or something, but in my fiction, I'm often like retreating to the self, because I find my own, you know, my own ability to inhabit the other, to be fraught, it's a very difficult thing, you know. I'm always worried about getting things wrong. And so often I write like pages and pages of characters and different voices and whatnot, and I often end up cutting them out. But that's important work, because then you really fully develop that character for yourself. And then, you know, you have the characters maybe who you retreat to interact with them in different ways. But I think that's the entry point, yeah, to be able to inhabit others. Writers are, I don't know, you know, it's not news to you. Always outsiders and weirdos. So
stalkers. In a good sense, in a good sense. I mean,
yeah.
Like
warriors and stalkers in a good sense. Yeah,
in not a creepy way stalking, but looking at people and imagining where they're going and what it looks like, wherever they're living and what they might be doing when they first come into the door. And I used to have a little exercise based on an exercise that an acting teacher of mine once gave us, and that was to observe people on the street and just follow them for a minute or two, not to follow them and be creepy or cause some weird stir or make them uncomfortable, but just to follow them to see how their bodies were moving, like where their center of gravity was, and try to emulate that, and to experience how it feels to go through the motions that you can see these people going through, and adjust your posture, adjust your gait, and see how that feels. And I always thought that writers do something very similar, and to observe people, like their little habits, the things they take out of their backpack, and come up with stories about them and think about them in a non-creepy and non-invasive way. Just where do they go? Like, what makes them pack this exact book or this exact t-shirt? Where do they come from where that makes sense? And in that regard, I always feel making sense of strangers is the first step to writing. I'm afraid of everything. As a kid, I was always afraid of everything, but making up stories about the people I was afraid of was a way of explaining them and making them less threatening because they had a story. They were not just weird presences, like the intruder coming into your house and wreaking havoc, but they have a story. They're coming out of a specific context, and then they don't look quite so monolithic anymore.
How old's your son, Joaquin, by the way?
He's 14. He's going to be 15 next month. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was just because I fixed on that moment when you said how you were going to explain that to your son. I tell him just some people need money and they do some things. And in a sense, that's a very generous, that's a sort of novelist's description of the character who broke into their house.
You don't want your kid to be afraid to be traumatized by life, basically. It's just, things that happen. And also, I had to think, and this again in the context of having a conversation with you, Jeff, I've been reading Ukrainian writers. I've been very active in my search of Ukrainian novelists lately. And just like everybody else, my attention is very focused on what's going on in Ukraine. And when something like this happens to you, I think it's very good to put it in perspective. Not that what happened to you is not important, but when you put it in perspective and say, well, at the same time that I'm suffering, these other people in Ukraine had their entire lives turned upside down, were killed, their neighborhoods were destroyed, everything they had was taken by this terrible war. So my loss is pretty meaningless compared to something like that. And this putting things in perspective, I think that helps, especially kids who need to keep that sense of safety as whole as possible. So maybe that's a thread for a possible conversation. These things happen, they're very common, you shouldn't be afraid.
Yeah.
Because it is true that other people are, going right now in the past few weeks through major losses. They lost family members, they lost jobs, home, everything they had, and had to run away with nothing. So what's a few electronics and a few, pieces of jewelry compared to that? It's really nothing.
Yeah, my wife grew up in Ukraine, in Kharkov, and after she graduated university, she actually moved to Moscow, but like her whole childhood is there, and her family was there. Her parents moved to Russia at a certain point, but her sister had stayed. So yeah, she was... As you remember, in the run-up to this thing, the U.S. government was communicating all the intelligence it had acquired, saying this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. All the Russia watchers were saying, no, this is not going to happen. It doesn't make any sense. But my wife just started talking to her sister every day and telling her to leave. But she was like, oh, I'm about to start a new job. The mundanity of life, just living in a totally normal European city, really, being about to start a new job. And then, 2 days later, all your belongings are in two suitcases and you're on the train to Poland. So, yeah. So now she's living in, she's actually staying with some friends of ours in Paris and waiting, like so many of the refugees, hoping that it'll be over soon and they can go back and rebuild. Just stunning to think about. I mean, her story is just one that, she's very fortunate in a lot of ways, but I think that it goes directly to what you're saying. It's just life can change so completely in a moment.
So. Well, you're very close. I mean, based on what you're saying, you're so close to what's going on emotionally, intellectually, as a translator of Russian literature. You have very close family ties to both places, Ukraine and Russia. This must be a really difficult time for you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is, but, nothing like the people in Mariupol or Bucha, all these places whose names we now know that we didn't know 3 weeks ago. So, yeah, I mean, I think I'm more with you than with them. I'm just watching in horror, like we all are, sadly, trying to help, reading Ukrainian novels as you are.
That was so interesting, reading Kurkov, for instance, Andrei Kurkov, the Penguin novels, and some of his essays. It's a really good essay. I think it was published in The New Yorker or The New York Times. I don't remember. But it's how eerie it is to read a book that's set in Ukraine, stories taking place in Kyiv years before what happened, and to imagine the lives of people in cities like ours, people going out to the cafe, people getting on a car to go visit someone, going to work. And then, have on the other, as soon as you lift up your eyes from the book, you see what's going on the screen, on the computer, on the TV, and you see the horror, right? The horror of these images that tell you that everything that you are seeing, that you're learning about in the book, is gone, is destroyed. That to me has been a really terrible, eerie experience. I never had that before. I didn't see live broadcast of destruction or what I was reading in a book as it happened. That was new to me.
Yeah, it's I think it's published in 2017 in Ukraine, right?
Penguin, I think it's from the 90s actually.
Oh, the Gray Bees?
No, I was talking about Death and the Penguin and Penguin Lost.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's 97, 98, something like that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we're doing this year at our program in Lisbon is we're actually bringing a group of Ukrainian writers. We decided for our first day, actually our first event, would be a panel with Ukrainian writers, and it's been quite interesting to try to put it together, because. First of all, none of the male writers can come, obviously, because they can't leave the country. But some of the writers who are coming, like there was this one woman, Luba Yakimchuk, and she was actually reading her poetry at the Grammys with Zelensky. Yeah, she's got this really beautiful book of poetry in English called Apricots in Donbass. Yeah, it's the thing that I'm most looking forward to this summer is to get these writers together, a bit removed from the horror of the situation, and you know, hear their work and talk to them about their experiences the past 6 months. So
in the run-up to this episode, I did a little bit of research about Ukrainian literature, Russian literature, and I was surprised to find that Gogol was actually a Ukrainian writer. And you, Jeff, once wrote a short story based on one of his short stories. Yours was called The Penis, and it was a kind of succession piece to the nose, a very funny piece for everyone, like, check it out. But I also learned that Ukrainians have often been looked at as peasants, sort of. It has a long history, it seems, and I'm basing sort of that on articles I read on The Atlantic and other publications, that Ukraine has had a hard time historically to separate itself or establish itself versus Russian literature, of not being taken seriously, of having to write in Russian in order to gain readership, and that in more recent years, Ukrainians have really tried to ban certain Russian authors and insist on Ukrainian literature. And some people have said that the war has made Ukrainians become Ukrainian, really, and to choose that identity. I heard a short segment on the radio the other day about people, Ukrainians, learning the language because they don't want to use Russian anymore. And so I wonder also what kind of role literature can play, what kind of specific works people in Ukraine might use to get a sense of community, to see that as a text that ties them together, that might fuel resistance, that might be sort of the birthplace of the modern Ukraine and being Ukrainian. And I wonder if you have any insights on that.
Yeah, Gogol's probably the most famous Ukrainian writer. And I don't think you're alone in, you know, not having realized that he was a Ukrainian writer. He wrote in Russian. You know, as does Korkov, for instance. Grey Bees is written in Russian. So, but there's a really fantastic generation of Ukrainian writers coming up right now. There's one writer from Kharkov named Zhdan, who's really a fantastic writer, Sergei Zhdan. And he's written a few novels, and he writes poetry as well, and is very active in the defense of the city, and he's been posting social media posts, like non-fictional accounts of their of their engagements with Russian forces and whatnot. And, it's really powerful stuff, you know, and he's an incredibly powerful writer. So I think in that respect, you know, literature is very relevant to this. There's a woman who many people have read now, Yevgenia Belarusets, who's based in Kyiv, and she's been keeping a journal Yeah, since the first day of the, I think maybe not the first day, but since very early in the invasion, about life in Kyiv under under this attack. And it was just incredibly powerful stuff.
And following on Twitter, I found really interesting links to people in Ukraine trying to publish nonfiction, kind of as it happens, reports from several cities. And but they're not easy to find. I mean, it takes some work and some knowledge of, you know, names and venues and what have you. But, you know, just spending a little bit of energy can be fruitful. I found someone that I'm reading right now, Oksana Sabushko, who I like. She has a collection of short stories called Your Ad Could Go Here. And then I purchased two or three other books by her, and I think she's very good. But like I said, I have no context to sort of make sense of these authors, because I'm not familiar with the larger scene as you are.
Well, I mean, it is, you know, at least on one level there, you know, it's a war at the crux of language in a way. So and, you know, language, as we know, is intimately connected to national identity. There's a really brilliant moment in that Kirkov novel, Grey Bees, where it's like, you know, there's this thin strip that's between the Russian occupied East and the Ukrainian occupied West. And there's two guys living in this little town. They're the only two left in this little village. And one of them is sort of a sympathizer with the Ukrainian cause, and the other is sort of a sympathizer with the Russian cause. But the first, the one who sympathizes with the Ukrainian cause, he lives on Lenin Street. And the other guy lives on Shevchenko Street, which is the, you know, it's the great Ukrainian national poet. And so one of them decides to rename the streets, and, you know, he gives the other guy Shevchenko, Lenin Street, and he takes Shevchenko Street for himself. And the other guy is very happy about that. It's a funny moment, but it just speaks to
right. You
know, the weirdness in terms of, and then both those guys speak Russian to each other.
Right. Yeah, it's funny until it isn't. It reminds me so much of, you know, tension that has taken place for so many years between Catalonia and the rest of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of my favorite writers from Barcelona are Catalans, wrote in Spanish. And just like, you know, the Ukrainian writers have written in Russian for so many years.
Yeah.
But the new generations of writers don't want to write in Spanish. They're, you know, embracing Catalan by default. And there's been this very nationalistic approach to language, just as we can see right now in Ukraine, for very understandable reasons. But what do you do with that other language, right? What do you do with the language of your ancestors? Can you really give that up? I mean, a lot of people, I read a lot of people in Ukraine are saying, I have given up Russian. I never want to speak Russian. I don't want to hear Russian again. But even if you watch, you know, that silly, not so silly, but that interesting Volodymyr Zelensky show on Netflix, I mean, the whole thing was made in Russian, right? Servant of the People. I don't know what's the name of the sitcom that made him, you know, a very important figure and eventually got him elected to the presidency. I mean, they're speaking, every single Ukrainian is speaking in Russian.
Well, I think that phenomena was pretty widespread, like throughout the Baltics, you know, where like young people just wouldn't speak Russian. you know, they would prefer to speak English with someone like me, for instance, who speaks like bad Russian. But I think it was, you know, in Ukraine, there's obviously a very large Russian speaking population. And, you know, in a way, the 2014 incursion was really, I think, the thing that created a backlash and, you know, maybe even made possible the tremendous resistance that we're seeing right now on behalf of Ukraine, on behalf of the civilian defenders and the military of Ukraine that made that possible. Because, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think if this level of invasion had perhaps been attempted in 2014, it might have been more successful. In the East, there might have been less resistance, far less resistance. You know, so much of this anti-Russianness was caused by the annexation of Crimea, the creation of these republics in Luhansk and Donetsk and everything. So there are some deep ironies there. I believe there will be novels written for many years about these ironies.
In your nonfiction book, Where Bears Roam the Streets, you have these beautiful accounts of traveling with your friend through Russia. And I wonder, have you been in contact with him, and how does he actually experience the conflict? Does he get the information from the West, or is he experiencing it just through the lens of Russian media, which are largely Putin controlled? Are you even able to be in contact with him?
Unfortunately, I haven't been in touch with him in years. That book, the origin of that book kind of goes back to the question that Joaquin asked me earlier about, you know, inhabiting the other and whatnot, because I'd been traveling to Russia since the late 1990s, and I really wanted to write about that place, but I was not smart enough. I didn't know enough. I was too worried I would get things wrong to write about it in fiction, to inhabit those characters. So the way I started approaching it was I just started writing nonfiction about my friend, you know, and going to the banyo with him and traveling with him. And eventually just all that material started to accrue. I started to, you know, in this kind of strict, like, journalistic writing about him, I started to see, like, some sense of my impressions of that place that seemed sound and true on some level. So that's why I sort of pursued the book. But I flailed around with that book for many years, and I eventually put a period on it in a place that I thought had a pretty happy ending. This guy who had grown up, you know, at this transformation of the political society, the country he'd been born in the Soviet Union, becoming a child of perestroika and whatnot, he becomes an actor. And I thought it was really apropos, and it had some hope in it and everything, but very shortly thereafter, I lost contact with him. Yeah, and he moved out of the apartment he was in. I think he fell on some hard times, frankly. He drank too much. We drank too much together. I think he, you know, might have been having some trouble with that, and
yeah,
money and work. You know, the financial crisis of 2009 was very difficult for Russians, as it was for so many. So, you know, yeah, unfortunately, I can't really speak to that because I haven't been in touch with him, but think about him a lot.
It took me 30 seconds to buy the book on Barnes & Noble, so I just want to ask our listeners to do the same. Buy one of Jeff's books because it's really easy. And I can't wait to read it, Jeff.
It's really a wonderful book. It's a really wonderful book, yeah. it's such a discrepancy when you share a language, and to some degree you share a culture, which is of course different regionally and all that, but then you're pitted against each other. And I think, Joaquin, your example of Catalonia in Spain makes a lot of sense, because there's of course some common history, some common traditions, but then also the long history of suppression, of being othered, of being put down, of being suppressed, of not being able to express yourself in your own language, of being ridiculed for your culture, of being ridiculed for your language. To see that right now happening here, not only like in war, but also in literature and culture, and how to emancipate yourself from this gigantic power that is trying to bear down on you, I find just very strange and very fascinating of how to create your own story, of how to create your own identity in opposition to this vast country that wants to destroy you and get rid of you. Basically, like you said that, Parker, earlier about that if Russia had invaded fully like in 2014, maybe it would have looked differently, but that in opposition to this giant quote unquote parent, you suddenly form an identity and maybe form your own literature, your own way of thinking in your own language. And so that this is the birth really of Ukrainian, modern Ukrainian literature that is not in Russia. We talked on a previous episode, it was Guilty Pleasures, and I talked about young German musicians suddenly in the 80s singing in German, which was really a revolutionary move. Only really old fogey singers sang in German, so very treacly, sentimental songs. And in the 80s, suddenly, with the new wave happening in other places, Britain, America, Germany experienced its German new wave, and everybody sang in German. And they were funky, they were weird, strange songs with often nonsensical lyrics, but in German. And it looked at least for some time like the birth of the new thing, and then petered out and everybody started singing in English again. But here, like it's interesting to see this is our country now, this is our literature now, and we're pushing back against that. And so that to me is a very fascinating birth of something new in opposition to something. So something beautiful within all the mayhem and all the destruction around it.
That's that would be an interesting blip to explore, that musical period in Germany.
Yeah, well, it didn't last very long. All the hopes were dashed. What looked like emancipation from the predominantly English language output, it lasted like 6-7 years, and then it was back to English. And something that what I read about Ukraine also like resonates in a weird way with my experiences in France, where I don't know what the current policy looks like, but for many, many years, France has really resisted using English language terms for appliances, electronics, and other. So instead of a computer, it's an ordinateur. And I don't know if, and really beautifully, a Walkman was a baladeur. And, but so they didn't say that. And so here also through language, this attempt to stay unusurped or to stay true to its origins.
National pride can also do funny things. You reminded me of the Freedom Fries after 9/11. But I do look forward to the end of this war also because I want to read the books that come out of that. Of course, national trauma does not necessarily mean that great masterpieces will be written. And trauma doesn't always mean that creativity is going to be served in the most exquisite way. But I have no doubt that some of the accounts, both in nonfiction and fiction, coming out of this terrible event are going to be very powerful. And that generation of writers that you mentioned, Jeff, the younger ones, and even those who have not published, who have, you know, who will come of age in the middle of this invasion of this terrible war, will have very interesting things to say in a few years.
Something new will be built on these ashes, that's for sure.
How are you going to be able to bring the writers to Lisbon this summer? Where do they currently reside? Are they still inside Ukraine, or have they already left?
I think all the ones we're talking to are currently outside of Ukraine, like in various European towns and cities. You know, but the European Union did a pretty, I think they did a pretty good job of giving Ukrainians kind of instantaneous protected status. So, you know, it seems like most of the people who I have any contact with, or they're all like staying, or rather than say immigrating to the US or Canada, though I'm sure there will be many who do that, but it seems like many are, you know, staying around Ukraine and waiting to see what happens and hoping that it's over soon. But so in that sense, it's a very easy trip to Portugal. You know, to come and talk to a bunch of North Americans and Portuguese who may have very little, if any, you know, direct exposure to that, or people who are, you know, involved in that. So feels like an important thing to do. To remind us, like, while we're there drinking vino verde and walking around beautiful Lisbon, you know, what the real stakes are.
Has this triggered in you the desire to write a book that's somehow connected to what's going on in Ukraine now, Jeff? Because, you know, you have a wife who's from that place, and all your friends from Russia, your years living in that part of the world.
I don't think so. Not for me. Like, I know that's many people's story. It doesn't feel like my story. I mean, certainly we've heard just the people my wife's been in touch with, her old childhood friends and whatnot, who are still living there, and their journeys out. I mean, these stories are just, you know, amazing. You couldn't make them up. But yeah, I think those are stories for others to write.
I like that very much, how you put that, other people's stories. That's very generous.
Yeah, it's a you know, there have been many discussions in literary circles for some years about like who can write which stories and whatnot. And, you know, I don't really have like strongly fixed opinions in one camp or another, but I don't know. My wife's grandma used to live in Crimea before she passed. And so we would go there. And it's such a, you know, it's such an amazing landscape. Like, I don't know about you, but, you know, as a writer, like, I go somewhere that makes such a strong impression like that, I immediately, you know, stories just start writing themselves. And, but at some point your internal sensor clicks on and you,
No, I understand. My wife is from Argentina. I lived in Argentina for 4 years. I could write a story about being in Argentina and about that place and about many, many things, but I just haven't felt compelled to do that, you know, maybe because I haven't found it. But I do appreciate the idea that maybe some stories belong to other people. Maybe they are not my stories. That really made an impression on me when you said it.
Yeah. I guess part of me thinks, you know, if something obsesses you and you have some knowledge about that, like beyond the cursory, whether it's, you know, you've spent some time there or something, like you should try, but you should always be honest with yourself. I'm at the stage in my life where I have more writing in drawers than I have published work. So most of it I can't stomach.
I don't know. So you're a pantser. Not a plotter, but a pantser.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we've, you know, we've been on a rather somber subject. And it's, you know, that's another thing. I feel like if I have a strength as a writer, you know, it's that, I don't know, if there's something that I try and do as a writer, like, you know, it's humor. But the world, the past few years hasn't felt very funny to me. So I feel a little bit out of my element.
Right now here at my workplace in Sonoma County in California, in America, and everywhere else, sort of on every level, like the very small cosmos and the larger macrocosmos, like the situation looks pretty dire and you can't really look anywhere for solace anymore. It's very disturbing, and I'll be one of the speakers at this year's commencement, and if they allow my speech to go forward, it will be a very dark speech, because I really feel more and more that this generation who's now graduating is the last generation to be able to turn things maybe around. It might be already too late for that, but they might be the last ones to really have a very, very big impact on everything, on politics in America and the world, on climate change, all these things. And it's a really weird situation to be in. And it's also really weird to talk about it before, because it feels always a bit self-aggrandizing, grandiose or so to talk about that. But it is really, I think, the last generation to be able to put the brakes on what we're doing right now and to really enact drastic change. After that, I don't think it will matter anymore. And so it's a weird responsibility, I think, they will have, and one they, of course, not necessarily want to have, but that they just do get because our generation and the generation before us didn't do enough. So it's going to be somber. I feel there will be a lot of episodes of somber themes, because that's just where we're at right now. But it's our fighting moment, and that actually feels in a very strange, weird way, good. This is our fighting moment, and we, even if we don't have the hope that we're going to turn this whole thing around, we have to fight against everything from right-wing attacks on our democracy to environmental disasters, dictators, everything. And this is our chance. This is really our last chance, and we need to take it and do as much as we can in our own ways to work against what's coming at us right now. And so that's good. It's really like our backs, I do really feel, are against the wall, and we cannot slink back into the private realm anymore, because if we do that, we're going to kill this whole planet. And so we just have to really take up, figuratively and for many people quite literally, we have to take up arms and just do our best in fight against
and our planet. Yeah, I'm sorry to laugh, Tim. I'm just picturing being one of those joyful young people in the audience at the
I know
listening to your speech.
Yeah, I know.
But everything is terrible. Remember that now we have new listeners in Ukraine. So things are looking up.
Yes. We have listeners in Ukraine. Ukraine came on board.
Yep.
It is time for our recommendations. At the end of every show, we have the FDF list, try at your own risk. So anything, Parker, you want to recommend, that can be books, that can be food, that can be music, anything at all you would like to recommend to our listeners?
Oh, well, I think I've probably already recommended it, but it would have to be Kirkov's novel, Grey Bees. So
wonderful. Cool. Yeah. Thank you. Joaquin?
Yeah, I took that recommendation last week when I ordered Grey Bees, so I knew that there were reasons for me to get it. So I'm going to recommend Jeff's books. I'm terribly curious about this book that I just ordered as well. I'm going to recommend that when you leave your house, if you have an alarm, you need to turn it on before leaving, because I didn't do that today. So that's my recommendation. Maybe, you know, put your laptops and your tablets under the pillow. Don't make it so obvious that people will find them and take them when they break into your house. That's my very pragmatic recommendation for today, Tim.
That's terrible. I'm so sorry. My recommendation is the ludicrous one, this superficial one, as always. I always recommend the weirdest shit. This time it's some whiskey, because sometimes you just need some whiskey when the world gets weird. And it's Lost Republic, and it's made in Healdsburg, California. That's a town just 50 minutes away from where I'm sitting right now. It's Lost Republic bourbon, and it's the coolest shit. So whenever you need maybe like a little bit of rest and a drink, or a cocktail out in your backyard, on the front stoop, wherever you are and wherever you drink, Lost Republic. Thank you so much, Parker, for coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
Nice talking to you, Jeff. Nice meeting you.
Appreciate it. Likewise.
And thank you for listening. The music is by Springtide. It's Coney Island Train Blues, and it comes to us via the Free Music Archive. And please listen to us again in two weeks. Thank you. Bye-bye.